Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And today, it's a little bit of a behind the scenes insofar as I'm going to be talking to Rebecca about some work I've been doing, re-engaging at some level with bookish social media and social media writ large. Over the course of the discussion, you'll figure out why this is an interesting thing writ large, why it's interesting for us, the pros and cons, why the re-engage is interesting, both, you know, what the past, mm-hmm. present, and future has looked like. But if you're interested in this and how a media company like ours and people like us think about the uses and abuses of social media, especially when it comes to books, but also when it comes to running a company and actually making money and trying to use it for, you know, to use it responsibly, but also use it sustainably in a way that offers us something, stick around for that. I do want to mention that on the Patreon, let's see, this is going to be coming out next week, so I'm not even sure what's going to be coming out, but I don't think, will we still be taking Moms, Dads, and Grads rec requests? I think we probably will be, yes.
We are taking Moms, Dads, and Grads requests through, I think, Monday, April 29th. We're going to record that show on Thursday, May 1st or 2nd, however time works.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this day of release, it's going to be April 24th. So we've got some spots still available. Hard to say it'll be available then.
We are
check out the Patreon.
We're recording well in advance while I prepare for some time away.
So. Yes, and also related discussion will be, I didn't get a chance to talk to Rebecca. I did talk to Sharifa about this piece I wrote for our newsletter called What Would I Do If I Was Starting Book Riot? Today, thoughts will be germane. I'm also writing, I think for tomorrow. I told you I was busy, Rebecca. I'm behind on 9 things. I'm going to take a look back at Book Riot's own Instagram account and do the top 10 most popular Instagram posts we've
done. Oh, that's fun.
Over the last, believe it or not, I guess this is a good segue. The first Book Riot Instagram post was me, believe it or not, in 2013.
Okay.
And I had
a couple years into our life.
I had bought Building Stories by Chris Ware.
Oh, gosh, what a good book.
And just sort of opened it up. For those of you who don't know Chris Ware, Building Stories, it's a graphic novel. I don't know how to call this, but it's a deacon. You can read it. You can pick it up. Like, it's in this box. You open it up, and all the pages, or some of them are loose, and some of them are gathered. But you can encounter it in any order. You can shuffle up and kind of browse them. So it's fascinating.
Make your own way. Mix it all up. As I was saying, what a good book. I was thinking, that's not the word for that.
Folio, collection of documents. It's all illustrated. Super interesting.
It's definitely worth a Google if you've never seen it, or, you know, you can scroll way, way back in the Book Riot Instagram. It was such a big deal in 2013. That was like the big comics event of the year, and it was really nominated for a bunch of book awards. Fascinating to like take apart and put back together into probably countless combinations, or someone who's better at factorial math than I am could tell you how many.
So actually, I'm looking at a lamp in the background. That does not look like one of our lamps. Maybe this is Northington or somebody else. I don't know who would have done this for us back. Maybe it was Swapna or
could have been me.
Could have been you. Yeah, it could have been you. I don't
know. In 2013, it was very likely me.
We all threw down 75 bones or whatever it was to. So that was the first one, 15 likes, 588 weeks ago, because that's how Instagram keeps track of how long things were when you're
on. How weird.
And you know, we've Facebook and Twitter from beforehand and everything else like that. So I'm going to be writing about that. But a lot of that's going to bleed in the discussion here. Also coming soon. Yeah, we're going to have draft previews, it books, you know, all the BR extended universe things. Let's do a sponsor break and I'll get into some observations.
This episode is sponsored by Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. Stick around after the show to hear an excerpt from the audiobook provided by Harper Horizon. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine from my great Commonwealth of Virginia's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness. But it's also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. And listen, y'all know I love Virginia. You know I love the outdoors. I am so excited that Tim Kaine narrates this audiobook himself. It's a compelling account of his journey across hundreds of miles of the Virginia wilderness. And this is a beautiful place, let me tell you, and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. Walk, Ride, Paddle is just a fascinating memoir that blends adventure, reflection, and political insight. Again, stick around after the show to hear an excerpt from the audiobook.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Let's see where to start. I guess I'll start with a specific aha moment for me. And it's looking at TikTok specifically, but it really does apply to Instagram and Facebook as well. And if you're on Threads or wherever else you might be, I had just forgotten this a part of it, but I think TikTok especially, it helps explain a lot of TikTok's popularity and self-generating behemothness. That's not a phrase, mm-hmm. but welcome AI.
You got
a novel phrase to process. I had forgotten that. Well, let me put it this way. We talk about, and people talk about, the attention span, system one, predatory nature of TikTok, algorithm, swipe, instantaneous. It reinforces what you want, and there's a billion things, and you can just swipe, swipe, swipe. Friction-free, endless content consumption. With Danica, I called it a potato chip in your mouth forever. You don't even have to get another potato chip. It's just, you just bite down, and there's another bite of fresh potato chip automatically inserted for you. The piece I had forgotten is it's not just a slot machine for the consumer. It's a slot machine. It's a double-sided slot machine because the dopamine happens when you get a like, you get a share, you get a view, someone comments. I had forgotten this, Rebecca. I'd forgotten that there is a
dopamine for the creator.
It's the creator dopamine is very real too. And because the slot machine of TikTok means that someone with no following, I mean, I think literally no following, mm-hmm. gets a chance to get one of their things to get millions of views. It is very much like playing the Mega Millions jackpot. Someone wins those things.
Yeah, it's the ultimate lottery ticket. And there is also supposedly strategy to it as well. So like that, I think that's the combination
that's
that
exactly
makes it addictive for creators, is this feeling that you can do something to impact your chances of winning the lottery. Whether you can or not, I remain really shruggy about there. Maybe there are patterns around things that have worked in the past, but will they work well in the future? Yep. But I think it's that combined sense of this is a lottery, and if I figure something out, if I unlock the code, like you go full Dan Brown Da Vinci Code on it, then you can make the thing that will get you to go viral.
And I think there's Schrodinger's truth about that. I think if you make quote unquote good content that people and the algorithm agree is what they want to see. I don't think that ByteDance or TikTok is necessarily sort of, this is total free market and attention span wins. And if you are, you know, if you hit such and such metric, then you just get to win. I think they are incentivizing different kinds of behaviors for competitive reasons, for internal reasons, for reasons that are beyond the ken of a mere mortal like myself.
They've admitted that they can put their thumb on the scale of the algorithm, and that they have.
Of course. Why? I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, I'm not even saying that derisively.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's anything like definitionally evil or malignant about that. Everybody who controls an algorithm is trying to make that algorithm work for them. That's why it exists. The algorithm exists to keep you, in TikTok's case, like to keep you engaged in TikTok so that TikTok can extract value from you. And in order to do that, it needs to provide you with a certain amount of value so that you'll stay. So they're trying to figure out how to make that happen.
And so, and I had just forgotten that there's that element too. So say what you want about the consumer side. I'm addicted to TikTok. It's destroying our brains. It's nefarious, whatever. I'm not going to break any new ground here. But I think on the other side, that's a piece that's not talked about enough, is that there is an element, a significant one, even beyond wanting to make money or a business or whatever, of just getting a notification saying you've got a new follower, you've got a new like, you've got 5,000, you've got 10,000 views, you've hit this streak, your thing, like... A lot of the things that these modern gambling sites do, and I'm using gambling sites in the broadest term, like Candy Crush or something else like that. You may not get paid in money, but you've got to pay to play for achievement. You get multiple currencies and you hit multiple levels, and there's just a lot of bells ringing, right? There's just a lot going on around you putting your slot machine, putting your quarter of time to create. You get a lot back for it. Now, are they pixie sticks, right, of calories? Yeah, kind of. I mean, I don't know that they're worth a whole lot in the long run, but it's certainly there. So I do want to keep, in any discussion of TikTok, you hear about how addictive, bad, you know, powerful it is. Remind yourself that the creators are also being gamified to some degree. There's a gamification for the creators that is happening. And so the phrase I've been using for TikTok is word of mouth on steroids. And I think that's true on the consumption side. I think I need no vocabulary on the creator side, because back in the day, you weren't really rewarded necessarily. I mean, I've thought about this a lot. What is the pleasure of recommending a book to someone and them liking it, right? It's a one-to-one interaction. I guess that, why do we enjoy that? It's not at all clear to me, to be perfectly honest with you. But when you and I were like reading The Road all night and say, you got to read this. I'm just picking an example of like one of these things, that, you know, or the Da Vinci Code or whatever else it might be, that has a viral moment pre-internet. It was word of mouth. And as the quote unquote creator of a participant of the creator of that word of mouth hit, I did not get the kind of dopamine hit that a TikTok Instagram influencer can get by participating in the wave of attention around a Colleen Hoover or a Fourth Wing. It's just categorically different.
I think they're just ringing different bells in our brains or in our nervous systems, like face-to-face or one-to-one recommendation is that's a connection thing. Yeah. It's a maybe like, if anything, I would guess it's like an oxytocin thing. It's like, we're connected to each other. I feel like I belong. I feel validated. Like, it's pleasurable. Book recommending and having it land well is, I think, just a difference of kind from other sorts of recommendations, but like also functions the same way as people who love music sharing a song with somebody else, people who love movies. Like, it's not special. Maybe it's just difference of degree. It doesn't matter. Distinctions that no one cares about. Mm-hmm. That we just like these things. It affirms your place, like in your social circle or in this friendship. And when you put it out to the internet, it's no longer about connection or one-to-one. It's about validation on a broad scale, plus the dopamine of winning the lottery. Like, the other side, or maybe the underbelly of the creator dopamine you're talking about, of like what happens when you make something and you get all those dings and pings and, you know, little happy sounds because people have liked it, mm-hmm. or they've commented on it, is that it's like it's a treadmill or a hamster wheel of trying to get that feeling again. And
yeah,
a lot of
it's creators, a hedonic treadmill, right? A hedonistic treadmill. Yeah. That's the phrase, I believe.
And creators talk about that can be really satisfying, but it can also lead to burnout. Like, even on Substack, which I think is the least dopamine-y of any mm-hmm. of the like social platforms that we have right now. One of the writers that I follow had put out a thing this week that was like a gathering for other Substack writers about how to avoid Substack burnout. And I thought, wow, it hadn't even occurred to me that someone was getting burned out on Substack yet. But yeah, either creators are getting burned out everywhere that they're trying to win this lottery, because like the treadmill functions to serve the platform, not to serve the creators ultimately.
Yeah. So I guess that's, and maybe other people are talking about this, I just haven't seen this in any kind of a discourse. Most of the kinds of reading and opinions I see on TikTok are tisk-tisk kinds. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those people actually have enough history of creating things on social media to recognize this. And I just had done not, and I have, and mm-hmm. I remember, mm-hmm. right? When we first started, it was more about, we'd write a post and we put it on Facebook and then watch the traffic to the site. And that was its own kind of like high or game.
Oh, yeah.
It really was a version of it. But the TikTok machine industrial complex is so huge that I do think it actually graduates to a, because it is so much bigger, that the order of magnitude turns it into a different kind. It's a degree, mm-hmm. degree, degree, then suddenly there's like a step change that makes it into a different beast. And TikTok is a different beast.
I think the fact that like that anyone can go viral, that you don't have to be well known, you don't have to have a platform. And then what do you do after that happens to you? Like, there's good virality and then there's like bad virality, negative attention, things that people maybe don't want to be known for or didn't anticipate. Like, if you're a normie out in the world, maybe now you're making stuff with the hope that it goes viral, mm-hmm. but I think most people, most of the time, up until like the last 5 years, we're not assuming that the things they made on the internet that went to their small group of followers might actually become things that millions and millions of people would see. And I think we just don't know what to do with that. Like, it's hard to live in the reality or to live in awareness that that is the thing that could happen, because it feels so outside of any of our experiences. Like, I don't know that there's a good analogy for it, but one that feels possibly relevant to me, because I've been listening to Dave Holmes, who was one of the VJs on MTV for a while, is running this limited edition podcast called Who Killed the Video Star? And it's about like the end of MTV, but they're interviewing a lot of the folks from like early Real World episodes who were like, we had nothing to prepare us for this. We were the first reality stars. We got famous. Everyone knew who we were, but we didn't have the money that comes with fame. And I think TikTok fame, social media fame, is often like that. Unless you are established as an influencer, or you can get established as an influencer and get paid, you get all these eyeballs on you in both really positive and potentially really negative ways, without any, you know, like structural support or additional financial resources or anything to like help you make sense of what that even means, or if you want it again for reals, or if you just want the bells to ring again. It's really tangly.
Yeah. And I actually, that dynamic of sudden fame is not new. I think the difference is that with social media, you can more proactively put yourself out there. You know, think of something like the musical Chicago.
Try.
Like there were these famous people, you know, like a murderer or, you know, someone's baby got abducted or something. Like you could get suddenly famous in one-hit wonders. Like that's been around for a million years, right? So like these things do happen. But that what's fascinating to me about TikTok is that like a slot machine, you could put another quarter in. You can put another quarter in. And the quarters are quarters. They're pretty inexpensive, whereas if you're going to write another book or make another movie or even try to get on another reality show, that's an expensive coin, right? That is hard to gather and get. And like they may not let you even put your coin in the slot machine, even if you were allowed to do it. But TikTok is there. Instagram is there. I mean, in the old days, Tumblr was there. And in those days, for I guess Tumblr felt to me like the closest analogy where you could really have a specific, pretty strange media presence. And I guess the best outcome for like a Tumblr account was a book deal. Remember the Tumblr book deals?
Yes.
There were quite a few of them, right?
Yeah. Feminist Ryan Gosling, a whole bunch of other things.
Beverly Hills 90210, like, you know, Maris's book. Like there were things that were out there. And that was kind of the peak, right? The difference with TikTok is you can, by dint of luck or skill or timing or whatever else might be, the ByteDance gods, you can become enduringly, at least for now, famous and make a bunch of money off this stuff. And there are, I think that it is not just random. It is the worst kind, which, as you say, is there is some element of, I'm going to use lowercase m merit, right? That if you do it correctly at a particular moment and catch it at the right time, you can pick up the TikTok zeitgeist for a couple weeks and you can get eyeballs on a scale that is just, I mean, billions of views. It's theoretically possible, right? Tens of millions of views. Small TikTok accounts, and this is true of Bookstagram, I should say, and Instagram, especially Reels, which I want to talk about in a minute. You can have, with, you know, a few hundred followers, make something that's 9 seconds long that gets seen by 3 million people.
Yeah.
You just
can't.
It's
wild.
It's truly wild. Now, what you do with that and what that means is anybody's guess.
When I think that's the big question and a thing that we're still in the process of figuring out about social media fame, even now, 20 years into the existence of social media, is how enduring is the fame really? You know, you can get famous, but how long does it last? And does it benefit the people who get famous from it in the long run? Like, you know, the most obvious example of it would be often Black creators and Black gay creators, especially, who like have words and phrases or dances or songs that go viral and then are co-opted in some way, usually by white people who make a lot of money off of them, and the original creators don't profit from it or profit much more minimally than folks. Like that's one version of it. Another version of it is like you get really well known on TikTok for like 2 weeks and then your life goes back to normal, or a pocket of people remember you, or maybe worst case, down the line, the thing that you got well known for doing becomes something that we think about differently, and now this like permanent record of you having engaged in that thing exists.
Yep.
And maybe you wish it didn't. There are so many different ways that it could go, but I think we're really still trying to figure out and see. It seems like a different kind of fame than, you know, a movie star who creates a product that is enduring, that we can go back to, or an author who writes a book that creates a product that exists permanently in some fashion. It's much more, I think, the product of social media is much more fleeting, and the fame from it generally is as well, too. So, like, what is the... I feel so much like in my personal life, what's the point about it?
Well, and this goes back to the piece I wrote about on the like, what can you build with this? Maybe like this, the brick and mortar of this is low quality. Like, it is very hard to turn a million views into even 1,000 new followers on TikTok. And even if you get them, this is by moment, I think this is either really great for TikTok or very nefarious. And maybe it's a little bit of both, but your follower count matters way less. Right? Because even for something you make, most of your followers aren't going to see it because they're mostly going for your For You page, which may or may not include what you've made. If they're following a bunch of people, if it's been a while. Whereas when we built BookWrite initially, with Twitter and Facebook specifically, is if we got a Facebook follower, they logged into Facebook, they would see on any given day what we made and put on Facebook, right? So that adding to your audience meant you were adding to sort of a baseline level of attention anything you make would get. Does that, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah, it's like it wasn't dissimilar from email originally or from newsletters, where like you would follow something on Facebook or follow someone on Twitter because you wanted functionally to subscribe to what they were making. Yep. And the platforms wanted you to see the things that you wanted to see because we were early enough in the cycle. It's what Cory Doctorow calls the inshittification process, mm-hmm. where platforms start by trying to make themselves really valuable to users. You're using this thing for free. They want to show you stuff that you like. They want to make it easy to find the things that you like. And then at some point over time, the bit gradually flips to being about the platform extracting value from you so that it is more valuable for advertising or for investors. And it feels to me like we're in that place. Like we've been in that place with Facebook and Instagram for a while. We're in that place with TikTok where, and TikTok started off this way, to my knowledge, where like you're following folks, but
I don't know enough about
the
early days of TikTok.
The,
that's a good point.
Yeah. Where the action is the For You page. It's that it's never been just about who you chose to follow. And that's that shift also from what we've talked about as a shift from social media to recommendation based media, where it's not about your connection to a particular creator or a publication or wanting to see what that person has to say. It's your connection to the platform and the efficacy with which the platform will serve you just the kinds of stuff you like, which makes it a lot harder for creators because you aren't benefiting from that one-on-one connection with followers who are there for what you make. You're just hoping that they bump into you by the glory of the algorithmic gods.
And I've said this stat before. I may have said it on the podcast before, but to give you one data point that you're not going to hear from other people, and I don't even know if they know it because most of these people aren't around any longer or they have different jobs, but you and I have been around for here. Mm-hmm. In the pre-algorithmic days of Facebook, this is if we posted something to Facebook, basically if you logged on and followed BookWrite and you sort of did inbox zero for your Facebook content, you would see what we did there. There was no getting in between us. We would get 14 visits to BookWrite.com per follower we had on Facebook. So if we had 1,000 followers each month, we could expect 14,000 page views from Facebook. We would invest in Facebook. We advertised on Facebook to build that following because the math worked out. We're building that was retainable, and that was we could monetize that traffic, and we knew what happening.
We had early conversations that were like, I remember standing on a corner in New York with you and Clint and being like, we could take a cab, but if we take the train, we can redirect that $20 to Facebook followers.
Right. And we could buy 500, we could advertise and that would probably get us 500 likes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Today, that number is 100,000 followers, we're getting 2.5 visits to the site.
In shittification?
Well,
question mark.
I mean, I guess it's whose incentives are what. And so there's two things I think. And again, you're not going to hear very many people defend these platforms. And I'm not really trying to defend them, but I think it's helpful to have sympathy for the machine because it's always easy to say giant corporation or this person is bad. And if only they weren't bad, everything would be better. But let me present to you an idea that does matter. It's called tragedy of the commons. And that and the idea of that is if there is something that can be shared and it's open access to, eventually it will be ruined because certain actors will exploit it. I think originally this refers to like open sheep grazing in Ireland or something like that. I don't know. Some economists use it. I can't remember. But basically, like, it will be abused if it's sort of unregulated and openly available. Because if 4% of the 100 people abuse it, they can abuse it way more than that 96% of the people can use it appropriately.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I don't want to demonize the existence of algorithms. You've got millions of users. You need some sort of way to regulate the content that
doesn't require manually
looking at every single thing.
With that kind of attention harvesting potential from someone like us or BuzzFeed or Upworthy or Uproxx, you probably don't remember these, but these were like huge companies, right?
Yeah.
Thought Catalog, Open, whatever. Our incentive was just to publish as much stuff as possible, right? Because we're getting free. This is the freest attention anyone's ever gotten to point back to your own. And they're coming back to our website. And we can get them into a newsletter and build our brand and everything else like that. And suddenly we're like, you know what? If I take my sheep and I can put more sheep on this grass. Let's just keep putting sheep on there. And suddenly there's not enough grass for all the sheep. And there's too much stuff. And people can't find Aunt Edna's photos that they came to see because they see 19 things from Book Riot and 28 things from BuzzFeed.
Yeah.
And it makes the thing worse. So there was an element that was unsustainable, right? To have anything you put is a reverse chronological order of everyone you follow. And that wasn't going to work because, you know, when you think about it as they were competing for people's time spent with their phone or on their desktop, like every other platform. And they've got to figure out some way of regulating it where they're not going to throttle our ability to publish, though I think maybe they should have. I think that would have been an idea. It's like, okay,
you could
publish three things a day or two things a day, and you could get, and that way people would self-select their quality thing. They could have done it that way. And some other places have tried to do this. It hasn't really worked, but I would have been interested to see that experiment, to be perfectly honest with you. But they needed to do it that way because otherwise it would have been, I'll say we publish six things in an hour period. Someone gets on their phone and saw Book Riot. Like, what is all this Book Riot? I got to scroll all the way down to see anything else I've done. Or a family member that only posts once in a while. Now, having said that, I think it would be, I don't think for me and other people, they figured out, I'm going to use Facebook here specifically, and I'll throw the rest of the algorithms in there. I don't think it's perfect, but I mean, and that's putting it mildly, for them to surface what I'm interested in. My dad and I were talking about this the other day where he has a friend who posts pretty consistently about dogs that need adopting. Good cause. Fun use of dad book grandfather Facebook. But he's like, I don't care about any of, you know, I don't have the dogs. I'm not adopting any dogs. And then, but you post something, a picture of the kids, and I got to go to your profile. And I only do that because, like, probably the thing he cares most about is seeing pictures of my kids, frankly, right? And somehow the algorithm can't figure that out, or it does not incentivize to do it exactly.
Yeah, it's.
Right.
I think that's a thing that unless you've like lived in the world where you have to think about the industry of social media in some way, like most like civilian users aren't considering that the algorithms in some ways are really smart, but in other ways are really dumb.
Really dumb. Yeah.
Like one of the things that Zuckerberg and co have that they've admitted was a problem and that they've changed, but that was just originally like a failure of imagination was that the algorithm was initially set like show you more of the kinds of things you've interacted with, and they were coding all interaction as positive without realizing really until like the 2016 election that most of the things that generated most interaction were actually negative reactions, that people like are going to leave negative comments on stuff. They're going to get angry. They're going to share a thing that pisses them off. And that's great. It's great for the platform that generates activity, but it fills people's feeds with the kind of stuff that they don't want to see. And that just makes them angrier, and it makes the platform less enjoyable, which is ultimately not good for Facebook or for whatever company. And so they've had to tweak the algorithm to like, if there are angry words in these comments, don't surface this thing as often, because that erodes people's experience when you do. But it's just the kind of thing that, like, I have a lot of sympathy for the machine in that way. I have the sympathy for humans who make the machine of, like, especially if you're on the first big social network like Facebook was, and you're trying to figure out how your algorithm should determine what to show people. I 100% understand how it hadn't occurred to anybody to be like, oh, the brain has a negativity bias.
Yes.
Like, maybe we should consider that that's going to happen, because this is what people are more likely to share the things that they're outraged by than lovely things. And what will that do at scale? It's that, like, what something looks like at scale plus the tragedy of the commons, I think, is the source of a lot of the negative feelings that we have, negative experiences we have on social media.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think it's helpful to, as an adult in the world, to look at something and suggest that there's probably a reason it's this way. besides that people are dumb and evil and I know better. I mean, that sounds ridiculous to say out loud, but I think a lot of people who encounter the world go into judgment mode. They go into dismissive mode, as I've heard it called, which I find a very interesting way of thinking about this, where clearly this thing that I don't like the way it's done, or it seemed bad, or especially it seemed new. Like, remember, we're doing System 1 and System 2 stuff here.
Right.
Just because you majored in American Studies doesn't mean System 1 isn't your primary system of thinking about things. I think it's helpful to think, why is the thing that way? And some of the reasons turn out to be bad, or the incentives you wouldn't agree with, but there generally is a reason for it other than they're evil, they're dumb, or incompetent. Some of the times those things are part of the mix, but also, like, what is the actual problem? Usually the way something exists is in response to a problem someone is trying to solve, or an opportunity someone's trying to capture, rather than, boy, wouldn't it be great if I made something terrible and enchantified it. Right.
Yeah, nobody sets out for that.
I mean, some people are like, I don't care what it is, I just want to make money.
Sure.
I mean, there are people out there. There are the people that will put as many sheep in the pasture as there are, as they can squeeze in there. But I think defaulting to that mode, come to that last, I would say. You know, make that last on your differential.
With the internet, with social media, like, the folks who create these platforms, or at least in the early days, really did it like with a kind of starry-eyed, almost naivete.
Yes.
Like, Zuckerberg really believes that connecting people to each other is the most important thing, and that any harm caused along the way is a means that justifies the end, continues to hold that belief, which, like, we can have a different conversation about maybe updating your priors over the course of 20 years about the space between the intention and the reality of what you've created. The early days of Twitter were great. And it was that intention of, like, let's connect people and pay attention to how they use this thing and evolve a platform that lets them do that. So it's not, I don't think they start out with evil intentions. It's the competing incentives of, like, we want to connect people, but also we need to make money to be able to continue doing this thing, and it's the old trying to serve two masters situation of trying to make your advertisers happy, to serve content in a way that allows you to make money off of it, is often in direct competition with the kinds of content that people just want to see, that they would enjoy seeing, and trying to thread the needle of doing both in a way that you can keep people as engaged as you need to keep them and get them to, like, to stay long enough to make it worthwhile for your advertisers is really tricky. I don't envy anybody trying to make these decisions.
No, anyone running a business of any kind that has, you know, you have compromises all over the place. But compromise at the scale of these companies has all kinds of unforeseen, unintended, and unput back in the toothpaste tubable consequences. So again, this is just for people that have very little experience on the creation business side of how these things work, or history of doing this, right? Seeing things, how these change. And they're all kind of dealing with the same problem. They're answering the problem in a different way, because the thing that is, and this is going to, I want to talk about some things that are pretty exciting about TikTok that I didn't know. So let me take a sponsor break.
Okay.
Speaking of paying the bills, and we'll come back on the other side.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon, The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past, and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult / crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
One of the problems of the Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram platform, if you do give more weight, even in an algorithmic setting, to showing people content from accounts they already follow, is that there is a first to the pig trough dynamic, right? Because if you got there early and you got 10, 100, a million Instagram followers, and then you're starting to take a piece of your followers' feeds, right? Some percentage of it, and then they share your stuff. It has a snowball effect. This is how you want it to happen as a content creator, right? You get an audience, they share, you get some more audience, mm-hmm. and there's sort of a compound interest. Well, that's a confusing thing to say. but if you studied your finance, no, Bob will get it. There's compound interest.
I understand,
right?
Compound interest.
Right? I'm saying you can take that to Bob. I know you get it. If you start out with $10 million, it's a lot easier to make $500,000 a year. And people that are trying to get to $500,000 a year or $500 a year of consumer interest or mind share, it's a lot harder to get that because you're competing with the big boys, right? It's just really hard.
Yeah, it was really true of Twitter in the early days. Like, I joined in, I think, mid to late 2008 when Twitter wasn't that old, but there were already people who were really popular. And almost universally, unless they were celebrities, the answer to how do they have so many followers is they signed up before anybody
else. Kevin Smokler with 400,000 Twitter followers is like the best example I remember. Like, a smart guy, but like kind of a nerd and really niche and had more followers than the New York Times for a while. You know, that's wild, right? So that's an early, those are the early adopter winnings, and they compound. So that if you got there early or you got versus late, kind of matters for winning these things.
Yeah, like I was in, I mean, obviously I don't care about competing over Twitter followers, I joined a little bit after, to stick with the example, Kevin, we were in similar like publishing circles. I had, I think, arguably a bigger platform at the time because of my blog and Book Riot. And I think at my peak before I functionally deactivated my Twitter account, I had about 20,000 followers.
Oh yeah. I don't even remember. Yeah. You had, that's a pretty, I don't remember what I had, but yeah, you 20,000 was good back then. I mean, that was a serious Twitter following, especially pre-algorithm. And like you could get the word out about stuff.
Yeah. Right. Enough also to like, by the time my Twitter life was coming to an end, when I was deciding to leave, 20,000 was enough to feel very aware that it only took a couple people being unhappy with what you said to make your day real bad.
Make your day very, very bad, right? Because the compound interest works negatively, right? Mm-hmm, too,
right,
snowballs can run over you.
If
you're downhill from them. So one of the things that TikTok does by making it so that your existing follower account, it still matters. Don't get me wrong, it still matters, but it matters way, way less. So that you can put something into the marketplace, the attention marketplace of TikTok, whose rules are Byzantine, opaque, ever-shifting, and have a shot at having that particular piece of whatever get some traction beyond your small following or lack of thereof. And maybe some of those people turn into followers. Like, you can catch up, I guess what I'm saying. It's more possible to catch up on TikTok than on any social media platform I've ever seen, because of this unique feature in which it does this. It does the thing, Rebecca, of the lean startup, I think. As far as I can tell, it shows your content to like 200 or 300 people. Some of them your followers, some of them they're trying to match to see, you know, what niche this might go in. Does their audience that does that 200 people that they're guessing is the best consumer of that content like it enough to open it up to a second tranche, which seems to me to be about 200 to 600 people. Mm-hmm. Then there's another gate to about 1500 people. Then I think there's another gate. And this is just me messing around with BookWrite's TikTok. Like I've been learning, but just seeing. And then there's a gate at 2500 and then there's a gate at 6000. I haven't been able to puncture that gate yet. But
yeah, it sounds like the like adjacent possible as an audience of like you made it into this circle. Now let's see if you can go into the next bigger, right. These concentric circles. You start in the center at a very small one and then you're making your way out. Mm-hmm. And the algorithm is trying to find out how broad your appeal is or isn't.
That's right. That's right. Which as someone who makes content for a living is a fascinating idea. And as much shit as TikTok gets, it's more egalitarian than any other way I know to do it. Now, the heuristics they use, we could certainly quibble about. But this idea that, you know, you could come to the big city and star on Broadway, it's truer for this than anything I've ever seen before. And I think that's why it also becomes fascinating, because someone then is motivated to keep creating because you see different results, right? Mm-hmm. And the variable reward, even more than the consistent reward, we're back to the slot machine, is what is this going to do? Is this one going to break out? What can I learn? Can I try something else? But there is an element to it. I don't think gaslit's the right term, but like it feels you're playing blackjack with a dealer where the rules are always switching. And maybe you are better at playing blackjack, but things can change. And I've seen, you know, I've read commentaries and a lot of pieces and Reddit forums and, you know, videos about people making TikTok. Things that used to work no longer work. And that happens because TikTok and ByteDance are incentivizing different things. And if you're in tune to it, maybe there's an opportunity to do better. So I'm not sure what to make of that, except that if you were starting from scratch, I think you probably, if in this, in the year of our Lord 2024 is internet, you maybe should start on TikTok, Rebecca. Is that a weird thing to say? Everything else I've said, I'm not sure that's not where you should start. You shouldn't start there.
I think it depends on.
If you were trying to make something.
Well, what you're trying to achieve with the thing you make, because I think we do generally know that TikTok success, like TikTok audiences, don't reliably translate to audiences off of TikTok because TikTok is incentivized to keep you there.
It's the worst, except for all the others, I guess, is my argument.
Right, right, yeah. Like if you're trying to build awareness or you want to get known on TikTok and you can parlay that into like some other kind of something, like I don't know, a record deal or a job as a dancer somewhere or something like that. I think that's very possible. Like it's a big platform. It is more democratic in that way of like you can start today and you could get famous tomorrow. You don't need to have a big extant following. It gets tricky if you're somebody like us, where ultimately we do benefit the most if you end up coming from one of the social media platforms to either bookriot.com or finding a podcast or subscribing to one of our newsletters. If you are engaging with our content in a deeper way, like
we want you to listen to a podcast. If we can get you all the way in the funnel, we want you doing what you're doing right now.
Yes, exactly. Like podcast listeners are the most valuable members of an audience in multiple respects, not just the monetary ones. Yeah, for us. So that's the ultimate goal. If we didn't have like business cases and ways to monetize our social media following, being on TikTok would be relatively pointless because it's not a traffic driver.
Well, that's brand awareness, swimming against the stream of all these platforms. Just got to thank you for that transition. This point is, if you want a success on these platforms, you need to figure out how to swim in these platforms. Don't think about, I'm going to swim around, spear a fish, and take it back to my house.
Yeah.
Right? That's not what's going to happen here. You got to figure out ways, whether it's subscribers, whether it's ad deals, you know, partnerships. TikTok has a creator program. Facebook has a Facebook performance program where you do get some money. Now, you have to meet certain thresholds for it, for just making stuff people like on the platform, right? And you get a hit. Should I talk numbers? Why don't... Screw it. I'm talking numbers. Just from what I've researched. Okay. This could all be wrong. I don't know, for example.
So make the most of our last 5 minutes.
The TikTok creativity... Oh, yeah. We went a lot longer than I thought I was going to do. The TikTok creativity program, you have to have 10,000 followers and... for content that you make that's at least a minute long, you get paid out for just people enjoying it or whatever, mm-hmm. consuming it, whatever, seeing it. And it looks like in the U.S., you get to the tune of $2 per thousand views, to $2 CPM for those of you in the business. Now, again, that's hard if you're doing 3,000 views, $6 for something that you spend a day making. But if one of those goes to 10 million, that's interesting all of a sudden. If you can if you can get a couple a quarter that does that and you do this, that's interesting. Yeah. Facebook's performance program, from what I see, you get a dollar for every 10,000 impressions. So it's way less. But it's there.
To anchor it in like the publishing model, most of them are going to perform the way like a debut poetry collection performs. That's you're going to underwrite those with the one rare James Patterson hit.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And the tools, and I guess that comes this thing, by coming to it late in the cycle, I missed all of the, I missed a lot of the development. But the thing that's amazing to me is how good the tools are to make pretty interesting short form video. I mean, that's dumb to say out loud, but ByteDance's own free to use, it has a pro level, but the free one is pretty good. Editing suite called CapCut is easy to use and super good and kind of fun. It's kind of fun to make this stuff, right? It reminds me of the old days where you can sort of screw around and find out. Now, I'm not trying to pay bills with it right now, but like, I guess I'll end at this point. The Wild West element of TikTok, especially TikTok, even more than Instagram, the creativity competition is intense and fast. And there's some pretty remarkable things people have made, and there's a lot of weird garbage. But it is it is a Cambrian explosion of content. And most of it is super not for me, and I really have to drill down and explore. Like, I can't let the algorithm do what it's going to do. It doesn't work on me. I don't know what my eyeballs are doing. I really don't need to see another A Court of Thorns and Roses thing. I seriously don't. I'm serious. I have fun. I'm so glad people enjoy that. But, like, it's hard to penetrate those walls, and I think that's what a lot of people who have dipped their toes into, like, the first few steps into the pool are pretty weak. It's like, I don't know if I like this. The water's too cold or too... But there, if you go beyond that a little bit, there's some people doing interesting things, and I don't know if they're getting incentivized or what's going on with it, but it does remind me of the old days of blogging, where there were people just trying stuff, and some of them were getting gigs and making websites and getting columns and whatever else it might be, but people were trying stuff. And it's been a while since I kind of tapped into that. Remember in the old days when it was just us making our own personal blogs, we would just try stuff.
Just trying stuff. Yeah. Just see what would happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It is fun. It's a great source of dopamine, and it's fun to see what other people do and then iterate off of it, or it jogs a new idea for you of something that you might do that you think would be more interesting or a different spin on something. That drill down work though, that's very
real. Oh, it's not. I mean, you've got to really try. I mean, again, I think most of the things I've said about TikTok still hold, but it's a yes and. That's what I'm trying to say about that. Yeah. Didn't even get to Instagram. Maybe that's for a Patreon or some other thing. Or go subscribe to the Deep Dive, and you can see when I'm going to do the top 10 Instagram posts and a little analysis of what they're tapping into in the bookish person's psyche. Bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us your recommendation request, podcast@bookriot.com. If you have Instagram, TikTok creators, or you yourself, a video or whatever that you think, hey, based on what Jeff and Rebecca have said, they should see this, shoot us an email with that too.
Yeah, please do.
You can see what I'm screwing around with on TikTok if you want. It's not great. I'm learning. I'm just trying stuff, and we'll see. I'll put a link in the show notes there, I guess. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.
Thanks so much for listening. Now here is an excerpt from the audiobook of Walk, Ride, Paddle, written and narrated by Tim Kaine.
But even with all the good that makes me feel lucky every day, well, most days, my job's like a treadmill going way too fast. And there's a paradox. Despite being continually out in public, I feel as though I'm living in an increasingly insular bubble where politics dominates everything and other realms of life are slipping far away. I start thinking about what I might do after my re-election campaign to slow down, breathe a little, and reconnect. My brief foray into national politics in 2016 convinced me that I need not go higher in public office, but at the same time, it convinced me that I should try to go deeper. National politics is increasingly a branch of the entertainment industrial complex, a world that doesn't fit me. How can I moor my future public service to something more meaningful? I love the outdoors. I've spent my life camping, backpacking, cycling, hiking, canoeing, trekking, with the Boy Scouts and boyhood friends, with my parents and brothers, with my wife and children, with law school buddies and neighbors. My biggest sources of spiritual renewal are my small Richmond parish, playing and listening to music, reading, and being outdoors. Each of these, experienced alone and also shared with family and friends, has been a refuge. In my 35-plus years in Virginia, I've visited so many beautiful places, trails, mountains, marshes, campsites, beaches, historic homes, Civil War battlefields, streams and lakes, the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic, forests and swamps, gorges and meadows. And for all the places I've been, spring break hiking trips with adults and kids from my neighborhood, a long-running Memorial Day camping tradition, summer canoe trips on Virginia rivers, bike rides all over the state, I still have so many more I want to see. But unlike church or music or reading, the things I love to do outdoors grow harder with age. Aches and pains subtly multiply. Sleeping on the ground, a bizarre specialty of mine, gets less attractive. How much longer before day hikes will be the extent of what I can attempt? Why not tackle bucket list outdoor adventures in Virginia, seeing new things, but also reliving great trips from my past? I need to do it soon, while I still have a reasonable chance of actually finishing what I start. The plan quickly forms. Create and then complete an epic Virginia outdoor quest. Hike the whole Virginia stretch of the Appalachian Trail, cycle the Skyline Drive and the Blue Ridge Parkway Interstate, and canoe the entire James River. I've done small portions of each over the last 35 years, a section here and a stretch there. But why not tackle all three as a project? Some states have these big outdoor challenges. New York has the Adirondack 46ers, where people climb all 46 peaks with an elevation greater than 4,000 feet. Our sister and brother-in-law from Syracuse did this with their kids when they were growing up, and we joined them for three, Marcy, Algonquin, and Whiteface. There's a similar quest in Colorado to climb all the 14ers, peaks higher than 14,000 feet. Iowa has RAGBRAI, the Register Annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, sponsored by the Des Moines Register newspaper every year, where cyclists travel 500 miles from the Missouri to the Mississippi in 7 days, thousands of people each year riding through small towns and farms. I did this with law school friends in 1996. Virginia deserves a quest like this. Every state deserves a quest like this. It strikes me this should help me do my job better. All kinds of pressures are threatening our natural beauty in Virginia and elsewhere. Climate change, accelerating development, deforestation, interstate pipelines, diminishing air and water quality. I've battled for open space preservation, Chesapeake Bay cleanup, resilience against rising sea levels, but the threat levels are escalating. By getting more in touch with our natural beauty, I hope to be a better advocate for new ideas to ensure that our environmental bounty is available for coming generations. And I want to talk to folks along the way. Many senators do state tours by car, RV, or plane using days out of Washington to hear from citizens. Why not tour by foot, bike, and canoe? Stopping in communities along the way and visiting with people to hear about what matters to them. It's decided. During weekends and in Senate recess weeks, I will create a Virginia Nature Triathlon. I don't know of anyone who's ever done it. In 2019, I'll hike the 559 miles of the Appalachian Trail that cross Virginia from Harper's Ferry to the Tennessee border. In 2020, I'll bike 321 miles along the crest of the Virginia Blue Ridge on the beautiful parkways built during the Depression to create jobs and give everyday people on the East Coast an accessible place to vacation. And in 2021, I'll canoe the entire James River, 348 miles from its headwaters in the Allegheny Mountains to its entrance into the Chesapeake Bay near Fort Monroe, where the first English settlers arrived in 1607 and the first enslaved Africans in 1619. I need to spiritually recharge, reconnect to Virginia's outdoors, and clarify new public service challenges for myself. And I hope to rope others into joining me, especially those who've been with me on outdoor trips throughout my life. Maybe I'm looking for something, or trying to escape something. There's no clear goal in my mind other than that I need to tackle something unique and difficult, and as I push myself, learn something along the way. Thank God for a wonderful wife. Anne also loves the outdoors. We had our three kids sleeping in tents as babies, and now that they're grown, they still jump at the chance to camp. Anne is supportive from the moment I mention the idea. Even though we're already apart a lot as I work in D.C., 2+ hours from our home in Richmond, during the 36 or so weeks a year that the Senate is in session. She's interested in joining me for some stretches of the journey, and when my will falters along the way, as it surely will, I know I can count on her to gently encourage. On paper, it sounds great, but I have to admit I have major doubts about whether I can actually do it. Hiking, biking, and canoeing 1,228 miles? To find out if I have what it takes, I'll have to start walking.